And finally, I would like to introduce Dr. Rhodes, whose topic today is taking sex differences seriously. I first met Dr. Rhodes 2 years ago, I believe, when I found out that he'd written a book called Taking Sex Differences Seriously. And after that moment, I used Taking Sex Differences Seriously as my quip for just about everything. So after today's talk, you will probably find that his wisdom is really helpful and full of fun facts you can throw out to your friends. They're free. Dr. Rhodes has taught public policy at the University of Virginia for over 30 years. For the last 15 years, Professor Rhodes has focused his studies on sex differences and their importance for an understanding of many contemporary cultural and policy issues. His most recent book, Taking Sex Differences Seriously, reflects these interests, focusing in particular, on sex differences with regard to sex itself, nurturing the young, and aggression. His essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, The Public Interest, and The Weekly Standard, among other publications. His most recent essay is The Emotional Costs of Hooking Up in the Chronicle of Higher Education, written in June 20th, 2010, which is my birthday. Over the last few years, Professor Rhodes has discussed sex differences and their implications on the Today Show, PBS, C-SPAN's Book TV, NPR, and many commercial radio stations. So please do join me in welcoming Professor Rhodes.
Thank you very much, Maria. I was say something else about the garden. When we say the root beer floats in the garden, if you're not from UVA, you don't know how special that is. That means right behind one of Jefferson's pavilions. So you're going to have a treat if you join us for the root beer floats. A treat in more than one way. Sex differences, we shouldn't have to talk about, we shouldn't have to convince people of them, really. If you think about romantic comedies, he's just not into you, or there's a one I love called Failure to Launch. But, you know, they're all about sex differences. I mean, how can there be any doubt about that there are differences between men and women? But that's sharply controversial in academia. And our conference today will try to explore what's not really heard much on the humanities side and much of the social sciences, although I do think the biologists and medical researchers and are absolutely on board with the idea, of course, there are sex differences. They don't think there's a big problem here at all. Okay, well, look, part of the reason for the differences about whether sex differences exist is because, shocking as it may be in this day and age, it's not considered. In other words, biological differences, biological variables in most social science are not considered. They look at race and socioeconomic background, education background, but not biology. And therefore, it's obviously hard to see whether biology matters if you're not studying that as one of your variables. But the standard view, I think, in much of social science is they're minimal. They call them gender differences. I'll explain in a minute why that is. And the thought is that it's to the extent that there are any, they're the result of a patriarchal culture and of media's propaganda, or even just family and then media, encouraging people to behave a certain way if you're a man or you're a woman. Now, gender differences is the approved view these days. And the thought is this: the people who want to use gender, they say, well, look, sure, there are physical differences, obvious physical differences. They're the sex differences. Everything else is gender difference. And a gender, that's meant to say everything else is created by society. And the thought was, well, we'll use these two different terms and we'll be able to tell what we're talking about. But the problem is the fact that women are more attracted to babies. Is that a gender difference? Or is that a sex difference? Now, I would say it's a sex difference. They would say, no, women are assigned the role of taking care of babies. You know, but I'd say, well, wait a minute. It's not society who assigned the role to have breasts and be able to nurse. And when you nurse, you get oxytocin, and that makes you more nurturing. So I think it's a sex difference. So the whole idea of we're going to divide this up and we know what we're talking about breaks down, because there's big arguments about whether things are sex differences or gender differences. Now, the thought is that if we could get everybody to think they're gender differences, then the thought would be everybody would understand that these differences are minor, they're created, they're not deep and natural, and therefore boys and girls would grow up and do all kinds of things, and some boys would play with dolls and some girls would play with trucks, and it just everybody would be individual and there wouldn't be any pattern because society would let people be what they are. Now, the problem is now gender's pretty much won the day as far as what you usually hear. You don't hear as much about sex differences. And one sign of that is I filled out a health form recently. And it didn't say, what's your sex? It said, what is your gender? So, and one wag said, well, it's a little bit like in Victorian era, they thought you shouldn't talk about legs. It's too provocative. You should talk about limbs. So now we don't talk about sex. We talk about gender. And even when you ask, which gender are you, on your medical form? Now, let me tell you a little bit about one of my opposites, someone who's on the other side of this. By the name of Janet Hyde. She's a professor of women's studies and psychology at Wisconsin. And she wanted to put an end to all this idea that there's big sex differences by doing what's called a meta-analysis. And the idea here is to get all kinds of good studies and aggregate them. And then we can find out, you know, well as we possibly can, whether there are big differences or not. Now, she found that there are males and females are alike on most but not all psychological variables. But the exceptions were pretty significant. One of them was sex, and another was aggression. And she acknowledged that the sex differences about sex, or the gender differences about sex, were large. And she also, what she said that on aggression, they were moderate. Now, that was based on a whole lot of psychological studies, getting people in a lab and say, you know, you're going to be shocking this person, and then we want to see for the experiment, go ahead, shock them, and they pretend to be hurt and so on. And then they find out whether men and women are more aggressive in their shocks, and whether it makes any difference whether someone's watching them, whether women are more aggressive if they're not being watched and so on. And, you know, and they end up saying it's moderate. Well, look, here's some of the evidence from around the world. Around the world, 25 to 30 men kill another man for every one woman who kills another woman. That seems like a pretty big sex difference. Now, that doesn't mean that the murder rate's the same everywhere. Sometimes it's 25 to 1 with a low total rate. Sometimes it's 25 to 1 with a big rate. But that seems like a pretty big difference, and we don't need to do the lab studies to find out whether men are more physically aggressive. This is particularly interesting, I think, because could we say that society encourages murder? You know, is a society, some people say society encourages men to be aggressive and it frowns on women who are aggressive. No, societies encourage murder, but there's 25 men who kill another man for every one woman who kills another woman around the world. So it's not socially constructed. There's something in maleness that we need to control or channel. Now, another reason for the difference I have with my opposites, I think, is they look more at behaviors and attitudes. I think behaviors and attitudes also show real differences. But I think feelings show even more difference. And feelings don't change with the times the way behaviors and attitudes do. For example, it's certainly true that if you ask the broader public, there's compared to 40 or 50 years ago, there's much more acceptance of premarital sex and of working mothers. Behaviors have changed about both those. Men and women behave more alike. And attitudes have changed. But feelings haven't changed nearly as much. Women feel cheap and about casual sex, especially if the guy doesn't call the next day or ignores them in a way that boys don't. And women, even though society may say it's fine for them to work, if they've got a two-year-old at home and they're working 50 hours a week, they worry about them in a way men don't. So those feelings aren't going to change the way attitudes do. Okay, now, another reason for the difference is this. It's sometimes said that, or it's noticed, and it's certainly true, that if a woman's a high-powered careerist and she has a daughter, it's more likely she'll be a high-powered careerist. So the thought is, it's a role modeling. The daughter picks up from her mother what's appropriate for a woman to do and proceeds accordingly. Now, that's one hypothesis, but the reason we have to consider biology in all these studies is that assertiveness is inherited. High career-focused women are more likely to have been exposed to more testosterone. And if a woman's been exposed to more testosterone, she has a daughter, the daughter's more likely to be high testosterone. So if it's the case that high testosterone women are more likely to be 50, 60-hour-a-week careerists, then we have to look at whether that's the fact that that's been biologically inherited by her daughter explains more than the fact that she was a role model for her daughter. Okay, now I'd like to conclude this introduction. You're going to see more of me in a minute. I'm going to introduce Steve Rhodes. I'm going to be back. I'm going to be talking about my lecture. But to end the kind of introduction to the conference, I'd like to tell you a pretty horrifying story. And in the mid-60s, identical twins were born, and they went in for circumcision. It was badly botched. In one case, the little fellow lost his penis. So then the parents wondered what to do with this guy. And there was a guy who was a so-called expert at Johns Hopkins who dealt with these things. They went to talk to him, and he said, you should castrate him, construct female genitalia, administer female hormones, and raise him as a girl. He'll never know the difference. The parents followed this advice and renamed the kid Brenda. Now, when Brenda was 13, the villain of the piece, this doctor, said she'd adjusted very well. Psychology and sociology textbooks love this example. The gender theorists, prominent feminists, they call this the case of the opposite sex identical twins. You wouldn't think you could have it. But the thought was, it was even pronounced, there was a cover story in Look magazine. She was said to be remarkably feminine and neat and dainty, and it showed that gender was socially constructed. Well, these claims turned out to be unconscionable lies. Many years later, a journalist went looking for Brenda and found he was now called David and living in Canada. He was married to a woman and the adopted father of her children. He had, it turned out, always acted and wanted to be male, and at age 14 had started living as one. His parents had told him the truth when he was age 15 and helped him to get a mastectomy, and male hormones began to be pumped back into him. Growing up, the first time he was put in a dress, he tore it off. When she was given a jump rope, she used it to tie people up with or whip them. She played with dump trucks, built forts, pretended to shave with her dad. She wanted to urinate standing up. Her elementary school teachers noticed that she had what they called a pressing, aggressive need to dominate. They said they'd never seen a little girl like this. The Brenda David story ended tragically. Soon after I published my book, he committed suicide. But the truth, when the truth about David surfaced, Johns Hopkins decided they should look at 25 other males, ages 5 to 16, who'd been born without penises, castrated and raised as girls. Turned out that all loved rough and tumble play, which boys and incidentally male monkeys like, but girls and female monkeys don't like. 14 of the 25 had declared to their parents that they were a boy. Now they'd been raised as a girl from about the age of one. And they, how often does that happen? And suddenly girls declare to their parents, I'm a boy. Johns Hopkins found two kids, who had parents had refused to castrate them and go along with this program. They got along better with their peers and were psychologically in better shape than the ones where they tried to change sexes. Now, Margaret Legato is a doctor who studies these things, and I'll throw out some books that are great books you might want to look at. She's written one of them. It's called Why Men Never Remember and Women Never Forget. So you might want to look at that one. But she said, you can't change people's idea about what they are. It's a result of testosterone in the womb. If the testosterone in the womb's there, they're going to think they're a boy, no matter what society thinks. Now, I think the bottom line here is that getting these nature-nurture stories wrong can be devastating. In fact, we're born male or female, with boys in varying degrees impelled toward masculine behavior, and girls in varying degrees impelled toward feminine behavior. Okay, that's my introduction. Now I'm the first speaker. There are at least three reasons why men and women have different natures. First, male and female hormones change behavior. Second, differences between men and women appear in cultures around the world. Men in general are aggressive and assertive, and women are nurturing, and these differences appear in all cultures, whether they're patriarchal or egalitarian, they pop up. Third, male and female infants and young children behave differently before society has a chance to construct their identities. See, a little boy and a little girl don't know what most boys and girls are like until about three. In other words, if you ask a two-year-old boy, do boys like trucks? He won't really know. He won't have noticed that, but he'll know, I like trucks. So in other words, and girls will like dolls, and girls will like dancing, and boys will like balls more before they realize this is what society thinks we should like. And parents who try to get girls interested in trucks usually fail. It's been said that they sometimes put blankets around the truck and put a baby in it and so on, and it just doesn't work. It's not a truck experience when they're finished with it. And throughout life, females tend to be more interested in people, and males tend to be more interested in things. Now, I want to talk today mainly about three kinds of differences. The first is aggression or competitiveness, and I think those two are linked. The second, sexuality, and the third is nurturing the young. But there are other differences I can talk about, and we're going to have a long time for questions. So I want to tell you some of the other things that I teach about, and if you're curious, you could ask me about, in addition to the ones I'm going to talk about. And that would be things like cognition. Are there differences in cognition? Why is it that men and women tend to, or do they still tend to drift towards certain occupations that are somehow sex-typed? How do they communicate? Do men and women communicate differently? What makes each sex happiest in a marriage? What's the secret to a good marriage? Are there differences? What makes each sex think about divorce? So I could talk about those things if there are questions about them, but I'm going to focus on what I think are the most consequential sex differences, and they are aggression and competitiveness and sexuality and nurturing the young. Okay, first let's look at aggression or competitiveness. Yeah, we can put it up now. I'll bring attention to this later. You don't have to look at it now, but and your this is in your handouts too. For aggression and competitiveness, men come to center stage. Some girls play more like boys and are aggressive more like boys, and they tend to have more testosterone. So even the exceptions, you know, we all know there are tomboys, but even the exceptions on average we'll find have been exposed to more testosterone. As adults, I've mentioned men are much more violent. They want to dominate. But in civilized society, actually low testosterone men tend to do better than high testosterone men. They do better in school. They have happier marriages, closer friends, higher status occupations. But they might not always be the he-men that women, especially your age, can be tempted by. There are two ways to reduce testosterone in men who seem to have too much of it, or too aggressive, too assertive. One is to get them married off. I mean, it's known that when men get married, their testosterone goes down. A second is to get, it's related, is to have them have a kid within marriage. Their testosterone goes down again. So instead of being out there in bars and, you know, making their moves and so on, they tend to calm down a little bit, less testosterone, get a little more focused, become providers and protectors of their wives and family. Now, the second way to make men less aggressive, I think, is to channel that aggression into other places. Obviously, there are some places you need really aggressive men, Marines, for example. But one of them is sports. And to control aggression and channel it into sports. Now, this is one big problem. I get in a lot of trouble for this, but one big problem I have with Title IX is, although it's led to increased opportunities for women's sports, it's hurt opportunities for men's sports. When there's a number crunch in budgets, lots of men's sports get cut. And the focus on equality in numbers of males and females in schools and colleges playing sports, I think, is misplaced, because I don't think there's any doubt that men like sports more than women. Who's complaining about them watching football games on Thanksgiving? Is it ever the woman? It's the men. There's something about games that both men get more interested in, and they want to play them. One side of this is intramural sports. Anybody can do intramural sports. Three or four times as many boys do intramural sports as girls. In college, I don't doubt that many women get a lot out of sports. I'm sure they do. But men need sports to control their aggression, and women don't need sports to control their aggression. Now you might say, control aggression? Have you ever seen these football players, the way they behave? And here's what I want to bring up to you. When you look at football players who may get in trouble because they're violent, and you notice that, well, the computer nerds, they don't do this. It must be the football. Look at their bodies. And also notice the computer nerds still like violence. They just play violent computer games, right? But the point is, both of them are attracted to arenas where they get to try to beat somebody. But the point is, look at the football players. Look at these thick necks and big shoulders. These are a sign of high testosterone. If you're going to see if it's football that causes the violence, we have to consider, first of all, if you're going to get in a fight, aren't you more likely to get in a fight if you think you'll win? So these guys are likely to win fights. So they're going to be tempted more to get in fights. They also have to look where they come from, often from poor, troubled neighborhoods versus more placid suburbia. But mainly look at these bodies. We have to look, if we're going to see if it's football that caused the problem, you've got to look at big, humongous boys who play football and from tough neighborhoods versus big, humongous boys from tough neighborhoods that don't play football. And an interesting article in Chance, a good statistical journal, says it thinks football helps reduce violence rather than increase it. Now, most violence comes from unsupervised peer groups, late teens, early 20s, boys getting together in an unsupervised environment. What we can do with sports is we channel aggression into a rule-bound environment. And one reason they might get in less fights than they would otherwise is because they don't want to get kicked off the team. Guys bond through activities. especially sports. Women bond through conversation, so it can be a big problem, especially with wrestlers, because nobody cuts football teams, you know, if they're making any money. But people cut wrestling teams. Over 200 have been cut since Title IX. And wrestlers are also big, tough, not always big, but they're muscular guys who like to mix it up. And I think it's important that we have a place to mix it up and get a little prestige and status on the wrestling mat rather than just cut them loose to see what happens somewhere else. Now, here we can turn to my first cartoon, which I think tells us something about male competitiveness. And aggression is just an extreme form of competitiveness, right? You beat the guy up or pancake the guy in football. Pancake means the blocker knocks him down and lays on him. He says it's all over. It's clear who dominates. Well, here, this poor guy couldn't help but turn this into a competition, right? He won. He lost more weight. And she got very angry. And then he says, I think, a very telling thing. He says, yeah, open, honest expressions of feelings. Yeah, that's what you want, right? That's what women want. If only we express our feelings more, you know? This is what guys express their feelings about. The Redskins lost, you know? And it's a different, it's just a different creature. And it's not always pleasant for women to see them express their feelings. All right, now I want to get to my second cartoon, Shereen. And this is also in your handout, so you can take it home and wow your roommates. Okay, the three-piece suit says I'm dangerous, but within the framework of the Constitution. This is what civilization is all about. Civilization is all about getting men to compete within the framework of the Constitution, within the laws, within a rule-bound environment, and put suits on and try to work for Coke and beat Pepsi. You know, that's what a lot of men get interested in. Okay, now, before I'm launching my discussion of sex and nurturing the young, I want to set the stage a little bit. I think that... okay, look, here, feminists who don't like me saying what I do, I want to first tell you what they say, why it's dangerous, how they think sex works the way it does and how nurturing works the way it does. I call them androgynous feminists, and I think these are people who think beyond the physical differences, there aren't any differences between men and women, and I think this dominates in organizations like the National Organization of Women and Women's Studies Departments and Women's Centers. Now, what would they say? They'd say about sex, the double standard of sluts and studs has for too long restricted women's exploration of their sexuality. Women's sexual liberation is an important part of women's liberation more generally. Young women should condition their consent to sex on pleasure and desire. An influential book, The Mismeasure of Women, Carol Tavris asserts that women should have sex for the sheer pleasure of it. Now, on children, the androgynous feminist says that women have to bear them, but men can raise them just as well as women can. In a just world, men and women would do everything equally, child care and work outside the home. And they're adamant about this because they think as long as men do what they see as the most prestigious jobs outside the home, then they're going to have more status, they're going to have more power within marriages, they're going to have more money. Now, my critique of this begins with an assumption about what most women care most about. Now, I'm going to make an assertion. I'm going to say I'm talking about most women. Again, high testosterone women are different. There's a minority of women who are more career-oriented, less baby-oriented, more assertive, relatively less interested in babies, but more interested in sex than most women. On average, they've been exposed to higher levels of testosterone. And I can tell you my thoughts about these women more during the questions, if you'd like. But I'm going to focus on what I think most women care most about. But with regard to sex, I'm going to, you know, obviously this group's a little different, a cut above. I'm going to talk about your peers more than you. Okay, but still, at least when I'm talking about men, but as far as women are concerned and they're thinking about sex, well, let me back up. I'm still not to sex. I want to talk first about what they care most about, most women, and that is, I say, emotionally close relationships, intimate relations with family, friends. That's the most important thing I'm going to argue. Now, one sign of this is little babies, you know, few days old babies. If you give them a choice between looking at a mobile, which is kind of like, looks like an alien, but it's shaped like a face, but it's got, everything's in the wrong position, there are triangles and stuff on it, or a human face, two-day-old girls look more at the face, two-day-old boys look more at the mobile. If a baby cries, girl babies are more responsive, more likely to cry in sympathy than boy babies are. Now, Baron Cohen, another good book called The Essential Difference, argues that he thinks most women are moved by empathy in a way that most men aren't. And this would be why the girl cries. And another example, if an adult's put crying in a corner as the experiment, and a little boy goes in, or a little girl goes in, little girl's much more likely to go over and put her head on the lap and try to figure out what's the matter. Okay, boys have passions for things. You know, it starts with maybe with dinosaurs and then cars and then baseball statistics. They can't get enough of these things. And then 3 years later, it's something different. Soccer, computers. They get together with other boys who have an interest in whatever they're interested in. Girls are more interested in sharing confidences in long, self-revealing conversations. I struck a chord, right? Isn't this just about establishing intimate emotional connection with special friends? Girls and women want connection. Okay, when they go through puberty, estrogen helps make girls more social, while at puberty, increasing testosterone levels help make boys less social. And then they begin to spend more time alone. Boys spend more time alone after puberty. One interesting example, if you look at male and female prisons, you know, here's a culture you just throw it into. And what do they look like? Male culture, aggression, dominance, hierarchies, a lot of violence. Women prisons, I don't know whether a majority, but large numbers, large enough that people in corrections talk about this, form artificial families. You be the uncle, I'll be the father, you be the mother, I'm an aunt, you be the kid. And they go on like this for months. Talk about the importance of family connection. They've got to have it, and they create one out of nothing if it's not there. Now, another sign how much women care about intimate personal emotional connection. If you look at unmarried, childless women, and you might say, these are the real careerists. They realize that families would interfere with careers, and they're going to say careers are most important. If you ask them, what makes you most happy in your life? 33% of these unmarried, childless women say, my relationship with my mother. 22% say my relationship with my friends. 11% say my career. So 5-1, even among this group, says what makes me most happy is personal relationships. Okay, now let's turn to sex. When girls go through puberty, the combination of hormones and their longstanding desire for strong, intimate relationships often leads them to be boy crazy. They spend hours reading romantic fiction or playing board games about dating. Again, I see some smiles of recollection. But girls are more interested in relationships that may lead to sex, where boys are more interested in the sex. In and out of marriage, women say they engage in sex to share emotions and love. Indeed, in marriage, many women say they get more pleasure out of kissing and cuddling than intercourse. Men like the sex, and when asked why they engage in sex, they give reasons that are more narrowly physical, such as need, sexual gratification, sexual release. Men have far more testosterone. There's no doubt that that has a lot to do with it. The best evidence is if you look at females. Women who have more testosterone are more interested in sex. They have more sex partners. They're more likely to masturbate than women who haven't been exposed to as much testosterone. On the other hand, if you complain that you've lost all interest in your partner, doctors will give you testosterone if you're a woman, because low testosterone is essentially a libido drug. And men, of course, have more than women. I'm sure that most of you are disgusted with the animalistic sexual scene on campus. It's one of the reasons you're here. Well, it's much worse in the inner city. The sociologist, I think I'm going to skip this part, because I want to have plenty of, it's natural not to be as interested in the inner city, right, if you're in college. But I assure you, if you think you've got it bad, the dating scene here, it's worse there. And it's partly because women have this optimistic outlook about men when they start. And this can put them in real danger. But anyway, a broad study of U.S. teens found and it's an interesting study because they're looking at the same teens. In other words, you interview a boy and girl at, say, 15, then again at 17, or 13, and then 15, and found that boys who had multiple partners in the ongoing a year or two were twice as likely as other boys to become depressed. But women were 10 times as likely to become depressed if they'd had multiple partners in the intervening years between the time when they weren't depressed and then 2 years later where they became depressed. An Oxford University book called Premarital Sex in America just came out. The authors report that having more sexual partners is associated with poor emotional states in women, but not in men. The more lifetime partners the women have, the more likely they are to be depressed, the more likely they are to report that they cry almost every day, the more likely they are to report relatively low satisfaction with their life as a whole. Women's studies programs and women's centers, you would think, would want to bring this to the attention of women, that men feel differently about sex than women do, but they don't, because this would be letting the foot in the door, acknowledging that there are deep-seated sex differences. Now, I want to tell you about John Townsend. He's an evolutionary anthropologist who studied casual sex among college students. He thinks he can explain why women feel differently about sex. As an evolutionary theorist, he looks at what kind of psychological outlook would be most likely to give you good airs. Now, you have to go back in time. Imagine eons ago. And let's just say we've got Erica and Mary. And Erica is someone who just likes sex. And she tends to have sex with guys who are interested in it. Mary is much more chaste. And she's much, much choosier. I don't know whether it was marriage back where we're going. I don't know how far we're going back. But the point is, she's looking for somebody who can be counted on to stay around and help raise the kid, be a provider. And she's also looking for someone who's a good genetic specimen, who's good-looking, who's has a high IQ, who seems able to do things and has high status in the outside world, so she's much choosier. Now, imagine that these two psychological predispositions go into the next generation, the next, and the next. Which one is more likely to be around today? Clearly, Mary, right? I mean, Erica sleeps with who? We don't know, with almost anybody. So she could have someone who's not a good genetic specimen, and obviously someone who's not staying around to help her raise the kid, those kids aren't going to be competitive when they, in turn, look for mates, right? But Mary's kids have essentially the deepest thing I'm trying to say here is that these psychological predispositions are inherited. So the Marys begin to populate the world more than the Ericas, and the Marys begin to produce daughters who have the same psychological predisposition to not like casual sex and to be choosier than men. And that's why, Townsend says, most women, despite their attitudes, they may say, I don't see anything matter with it. I'm not particularly religious and so on. In time, don't like casual sex. They feel used and demeaned and feel I should be getting something out of this, some commitment more than I am. Now, boys, a guy who slept with a whole lot of women, he may be putting his genes throughout very successfully in the future generations. So Townsend thinks that's one of the reasons why they aren't turned off by casual sex in the way women are. Boys, you could say, has a dual strategy. You could be a cad or a dad and be successful. The cads just sleep with a lot of women, don't pay any attention to the kids that result, but some of them will turn out all right. And the dad says, I'm going to stay here and be a provider and a protector, and we're going to have three good kids who are going to be especially good mates who will come out of this, and they're going to be especially lucky or good at finding finding the kind of mates that most boys and girls or men and women are looking for. Okay, so one thing is, how do you get men to behave more like dads than cads? That's kind of a big issue for civilization. Okay, now, one thing Townsend, you know, that he may not be wrong about the theory, but one thing he clearly shows is that men and women feel differently about casual sex. One of the questions, he talked to 250 college students at Syracuse University, and then narrowed it down to the 50 who had been the most sexually active. And then he asked them how they react to the following statement. Even if I think I don't want to be emotionally involved with a person, if I have sex with him or her a few times, I begin to feel vulnerable and would at least like to know that he or she cares about me. Now, only 4% of women disagreed with that. They want to at least feel the guy cares about them. 50% of men disagreed with the statement. They didn't care whether the people they slept with cared about them or not. Townsend gives a full description of the sexual outlook of the 5 most sexually active women he encountered. 4 of the 5 said they did not think you should have to be emotionally involved before having sex. And the other one said she used to think that way, but it changed. Despite these sexually liberated attitudes, each of the 5 now found that their emotions, their feelings, interfered with casual sex. They felt hurt, demeaned, used when sleeping with guys who weren't interested in relationships. This wasn't true of the most sexually active men. Now, after college, women have cohabitation too often to look forward to. As one study said, women tend to see living together as a step toward marriage, while men regard it more as a sexual opportunity without the ties of long-term commitment. Stefan Bechtel is an author who's written about sex and relationships with males and then females, did a couple thousand interviews with both. And a reporter asked him, what's the biggest difference? He said, rage. Women feel rage at men. Men don't feel any rage at women. And this is confirmed if you look at a bookstore. There's titles aimed at women with titles like How to Heal the Heart by Hating and The Woman's Book of Revenge. And that one says things like, how do you get even with it? Go mess up his stuff and stuff like this, you know? So the point is, a lot of innocent, you know, I guess, women get led on to believe men are at a certain place and they're not. And if we stop telling women and men there's no significant difference between them in this regard, I think there'll be less female depression and less rage at men. And love and fidelity, women are probably well aware of that, but to change the culture of women, women have to change first if this is to change, it seems to me. They're more vulnerable to emotional pain and they usually don't get much pleasure out of casual sex. And I'll give you one last cartoon here. Oops, that's not what we want. That's upside down. Here we go. And this one you got in your handout to take home too, if you'd like. This is Doonesbury. They're interested in a really major bay, but they figure they need a business plan to attract one. And the one guy lying around says, you know what would be even cooler than a major babe? If we could find a major babe with a business plan. I mean, this is kind of where the culture is these days. Here's the way historically evolutionists would say it worked. Women got things out of sex. If it's a marrying culture, they got a provider and protector. If it's not a marrying culture, they got a hunk of beef or something. You know, these days, you know, it's just you want to come over and hang out, we'll watch the tube, you know, that's considered a date. And the thought is that's going to lead to sex. You know, this is, in some measure, women are creating these lazy bums, is what you could say this is all about here, by being too available. You know, it's often said women should, sex is too important to play games about it. You shouldn't play hard to get. I would say, right, it isn't a game. You should be hard to get because that way you'll be hard to hurt. But in the longer run, I think we can bring men into the picture. You know, it's obvious, I think, to everybody that sex is different than tennis. if Joe sees Jim, say, I'm supposed to have play tennis with Nancy next week. Can you fill in? I can't make it. Or says, I'm supposed to have sex with Nancy next week. Could you fill in? I can't make it. Somehow everybody knows that's a different deal. And, of course, there are risks for men with casual sex. They can get pregnant. You know, the woman, we're assuming now the guy's not interested in this woman he's sleeping with, but if she gets pregnant, this woman he's not interested in is in his life for the next 20 years. And, of course, there's some risk of venereal disease, not as much as for men. There's some risk of depression. But more importantly, I think once we can get it established that women don't like casual sex, then men can be instructed. We'll see what they're made of. As long as we have this mixed view, oh, they seem to like it. I didn't have to do it if you didn't want. You know, as long as there's this no agreement, which we're about what I think there should be, that very, very few women, after a period of time, like casual sex. They might, for a period of time, think it's kind of an adventure. But then we see whether these guys have guilty consciences. Maybe Love and Fidelity men can help them get one by talking about the tears they've seen and telling them that they think they behave like a scumbag. Now, it's not impossible to imagine a different culture on this regard. And I want to take you back to the Victorian era in Pride and Prejudice. You know, this Victorian era followed a period with much looser sexual standards. So it's not impossible things to get churned around. You probably read in the paper just last week that there's an increase in the number of teens and near teens who abstain. That's what the trend is toward. But anyway, what I like about Pride and Prejudice in this regard is I want you to focus on the Gardners. They're a bit couple, but they were a happily married couple who were in there, and they're advisors to Mr. Bennet when Wickham runs off with Lydia. And the Gardners say, I think he must plan to marry her. I mean, he couldn't just run off and play with her and just leave her. I mean, he couldn't, essentially they say, you know, it's too great a violation of decency and honor and of his interest. Essentially, they're saying he couldn't show his face anywhere in England if it, knowing that he'd done that. You know, you don't run off with a 16-year-old girl and trifle with her affections and then just leave her. So this is a story then partly about men protecting women against other men. And the Victorians were great about this because they found a way, you know, lots of men are very interested in sleeping with lots of young women, but they're also very interested in having high status. And the Victorians said, you can't do both. You know, and the men helped enforce that by who they were willing to socialize with. Now, finally, on sex, I'd like to conclude by a quote that I like so much, I put it in your handout, but it's by Mary Elizabeth Pottles, and it says, in serious courtship, a man conveys to a woman that if she's worth all this trouble to court, she must be worth more than any other mate in the world, and she'll henceforth be the one woman. On her part, the woman promises that if she was this hard for him to get, surely she will, as his wife, be impossible for others to get. The courtship dance is the unspoken pledge of future fidelity, the best of all bases for a happy marriage. In other words, when the guy shows up on Saturday night and both he and she are aware of the fact that things could progress more quickly physically with another woman, and still every Saturday night he ends up at your doorstep and wants to see you, it's a pretty good sign that he really cares about you, not just the fact you're very pretty, and a sign that this is a guy you can count on. He's capable of being faithful. For the woman, you know, she ends up marrying this guy. She obviously cared about him, but she also signals how hard it was for him to get her. And this is a sign, once I'm married, you don't have to worry about reproducing someone else's kids. And the other quote is from Yeats, and it's just a little phrase saying, how but in custom and ceremony are innocence and beauty born? And I think that's what lots of manners were about, that it seemed to fall, you know, you open doors for ladies. You make sure your date has some food and drink before you get some. These were all common things that I grew up with. And men are more tunnel vision. They tend not to notice what other people need as much. Not incidentally, it makes the men more noticing of what's going on around them, what other people's needs are. But Charlotte Allen has talked about how we jeered at emotion and ceremony as repressive and sexist, and in the process obliterated innocence and created a culture of ugliness. Okay, now, let me move on to nurturing the young. Oxytocin is a big, big hormone here. Women have more receptors for it. When they get pregnant, they get more. When they nurse, they get more. It's a bonding hormone. The predominantly male hormone, testosterone, is not only not bonding or nurturing, it's anti. In other words, the more more testosterone you have, the less interested you are in babies. So high testosterone women are less interested in babies than low testosterone women. If you inject a monkey with a baby with testosterone, it becomes less interested in its baby. So to show how unlikely it is that men and women are both going to be equally good at nurturing babies, just remember testosterone isn't neutral. It's an anti-nurturing drug. It doesn't mean men can't nurture, but the testosterone part doesn't help. And it's good that it goes down after marriage and down again after baby. But the greater attachment of women also creates more vulnerability for them. They care more when the kid's crying. They care more when the kid has trouble. It's much harder for a mother to find happiness in any part of her life if one of her kids is really struggling or really has problems. Men are a little bit easier to compartmentalize and find happiness in some other part. When a mother hearing a baby cry at night wakes up concerned, a man doesn't wake up often. If he does, he may be annoyed more than he is concerned. One study looked at families where the parents both performed at least 35% of the child care. So they're both really into it. But they asked both mother and father, who's more emotionally involved with the kids' lives? They all said the mother. Not all, but the clear majority said the mother. They were more worried when they were absent from their children, the mother was. They had more difficulty concentrating on other tasks than the father did. If you look in Sweden, they've been emphasizing androgyny forever. And but the traditional parenting differences continues to exist. When the male goes back after father's leave, he's more eager to do it than the mother is after her leave is up. And what the most convincing on this is, they looked at a very untraditional families. They looked at, in Sweden now, a man who said, after the birth of my kid, I want to be the principal caretaker. And they said, well, I want to go into those homes and see what's happening there. They go into those homes and find the following. Mothers, more than fathers, showed more affectionate behavior, vocalized more to the infant, smiled more, tended to it more, held it more, and soothed it more than the fathers. Even these fathers who said, I want to be the principal caretaker. How important are children to mothers? Mothers report liking parenting more than fathers. Now, fathers get to do the fun stuff. They usually teach them something, read to them, play with them. Mothers change the diapers, you know, wash the clothes. Why would mothers say they like it more? Because they somehow are drawn to it more. And that's what they say. They like it more. I did a study of tenure-track women desperately trying to get tenure who also had a kid under two. The women were much more likely than the men who were tenure-tracked to say, I want to have a baby now. Even though they knew it would interfere with their kid. So also I think women are better able to be good parents. They are better able than fathers to distinguish a cry of pain from one of hunger or one of anger. They read body language much better. I don't think daycare is the answer, because if women feel as they do, I want to be with the kid and I want to, and I feel guilty when I'm not with the kid, daycare, no matter how good it is, doesn't help. And daycare's got some problems you don't hear much about, mainly because the women who do the daycare studies use daycare. You know, how would you feel if everybody who studied secondhand smoke was a smoker? You'd say, well, I'd rather have somebody else take a look at it. You know, this is a problem we've got with daycare. There are women doing the studies, and they all use daycare. But anyway, my reading of the daycare studies is that, well, first of all, infection rates are very high. Every couple of minutes, a little kid in daycare puts his hand in his mouth, and he's touching the toys. Just look at one difference, ear infections. These can be serious, leading to hearing loss and leading to social difficulties if you lose your hearing. We spend $3 to $4 billion a year on surgical drains in children's ears. These infections are 7 times more common in daycare infants and children than they are in others. But there are also psychological effects. It can be shown that kids are more needy and disobedient and aggressive if they've been in daycare when they get to kindergarten. I'll tell you only about one study, which I think is really neat. It was done in Quebec. It was kind of a natural experiment because they had data on how kids were doing in Quebec before they got $5 a day daycare. That's what they ended up with in Quebec. They had a brand new social policy. Put your kid in daycare all day for $5. That weren't any changes in the other provinces, so you could compare the kids in Quebec before the daycare and those kids after, and you can compare them with other provinces. And here are the results. The kids after the daycare was encouraged in this way were more aggressive, more anxious, more hyperactive than those in other provinces. They were more ill than previously. There was a decline in their motor skills. Incidentally, also problems with the families. There was a more hostile and inconsistent parenting, worse adult mental health, lower relationship satisfaction. It's just a pretty overwhelming study, and these were the results. Now, remember, the daycare kids don't just affect those families. If they're more aggressive and acting out in school, they affect everybody who's in the kindergarten. Everybody is in the first grade. And so I think it's worth worrying about. Another thing we can show is cortisol, which is a stress hormone, is greater at 2 p.m. in daycare in a kid than it is at 2 p.m. on Saturday when he's home. Now, having a really important job doesn't make women dramatically different in how they feel about all these things. I'm going to give you just one of the examples I use in my book. Madeline Coonan, she was the governor of Vermont. She was the mother of 4 children when she was there. At least once a day, she reported in her autobiography, "I would feel a stab in my chest, thinking I should be at one place when I was at another. There was no cure for my anxiety. All I could do was not to let it overwhelm me, not to let it pull me down, but to carry it as gracefully as I could." In one case, she says she was home late for the birthday party. And they'd already blown out the candles. She made them light them again, blow them out again. Now, that wasn't for the benefit of the kid, right? She wanted to see the candles being blown. The mothers want to see the first steps. They want to hear the first voices, first sounds, the first words. One study of sex differences in psychological stress among married couples concludes that for wives but not husbands, it's especially stressful to be married and employed with minor children. A second study that compares working and non-working mothers finds the working mom's pervasive internal struggle was as common among mothers with teenagers as it was with those with toddlers. And it was as common, it didn't matter whether the father was really supportive of her work. They just felt this unease. Now, I suspect that when you were in school, nobody said women will have these kind of jobs and they might want to go part-time, so it's a little bit different kind of job, and men will have these kinds of jobs. It was just assumed they all have the same kind of jobs, right? But a Pew study in 2007 that asked about what people's preferences are between part-time work, full-time work, or no work, the number of women who had kids under 17, now we're not talking about infants, kids are under 17, who said the best solution for me would be full-time work, that was 21%. The percentage of men who said the best solution for me would be full-time work was 72%. That's a pretty big difference about what the preferences are. There's a lot of women doing full-time work who would rather do half part-time work. Now, let me tell you about PhD students, our most talented people. You see big differences. There have been studies looking at the same girls when they were 12 and then looking at them when they were 32. Same boys in 12 and then 32. They have different interests all along. All along, women are more social, more interested in people. A lot of them get taken off the math track to be doctors because they want to have interaction with people. And where they found that, look, these brilliant people who have PhDs now, top 1%, they still want to pursue their intellectual inquiries. They still want to have an influence in the community, but the men are more driven, the men are more career-oriented than the women are among these equally talented people. One sign of this, if you simply ask, if you could have your ideal job, these are 32-year-old women and men, how many hours a week would you want to work? 28% of these most talented women say less than 40 hours a week. 5% of the men say less than 40 hours a week. Okay, if we turn from mothers' feelings to children's feelings, we find that children's reactions to parents can be remarkably gendered. One study found if mothers work more, her child's grades go down. If fathers work more, his child's grades go up. If mom really loves her dad, if mom really loves her job, teenage girls' psychological health declines. But if dad really likes his job, teenage girls' psychological health increases. All in all, since mothers don't want to spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week away from their kids, and they worry about them when they do, and since they're better with kids than young kids than fathers are, it's reasonable to conclude, I think, that we don't want men and women, if they're both to be equally happy, to have the same kinds of patterns on average in how much time they spend at home and how much at the work. And the attempt to do this, the Androgynous Project, I think, can be seen as misogynist, given what women's preferences are. You're talking about a minority of women who want what now says they want. Now, look, the two-career family, I think, is too often produces angry, exhausted mothers desperate for a home that feels like a home. And I think this bothers the men. In fact, the evidence shows women who work long hours and women who make more than their husbands is not good for the men. Now, I think this is partly because these women will seem haggard and harried. And the man thinks, I'm supposed to be the provider and protector. Why does she look like that? You know, I must be doing something wrong. Now, in most marriages, I think most of you, I think, I'm not as prescriptive as this sounds. There's some women who say, I'd go nuts at home, and I'm going to take their word for it. And, you know, but I'm just saying, in average, most women would go nuts if they work 50 or 60 hours a week, if they have a one-year-old at home. That's what the evidence shows. And I think... I don't think I'm insulting women at all with this analysis, because I think women make wonderful doctors, wonderful lawyers, every bit as good as men. There's another dimension to life which they're better at than men. That's what the problem is. They're better at raising young children. And this is what complicates the career roles. Now, I don't think there's any evidence that women who make less money have less marital power, that they're fathers push them around. Brad Wilcox will be with us, I think, will say that's not the typical situation. I just think generally women have a different understanding of power than men do. One of the reasons men can get so excited about, I'm getting a Pepsi ad and boy, we're gonna knock the pants off Coke, is it's a competition. They're just in the competition everywhere. You wanna get guys who can do well in school, put them in different teams and have a spelling bee. You know, competition. That's what they want. But women say, you know, I've done this for 10 years trying to help Pepsi beat Coke. I don't really care whether Pepsi beats Coke. But men can care, you know, because it's a sign of status. I had a good one getting a raise, you know, all this stuff. But women, I think, see a different kind of power. This is a very wise comment that I think I also include in your handout. Women often want to create the power that creates relationships, that binds families, and that builds societies. If there's a dining room table arguments, they put mics underneath the dining room table. Who's most likely to make them dissolve, to be the peacemaker? Number one, mother. Number two, daughter. You know, women are good at making things work in society and families. Building societies, binding families, creating relationships. And that's a kind of power. It's a kind of power I think we need more of. And women who say they like to see themselves as loving, sympathetic, and generous are probably better able to bring it about than men are. Now, I want to end by just one anecdote that I love, because it had nothing to do with gender. The people doing the research were simply from the Forest Department. They were trying to find out what people like to recreate, how they like to recreate outdoors. So they just asked people, what do you like to do when you're outdoors? And men would say, oh, I like to play tennis, I like to hunt, I like to fish, I like to golf. Some women would say, I like to play tennis, I like to go jogging. But a lot of women would say, we like to go boating. We like to go water skiing. We like to, same question. What do you like to do? Well, we use kind of ambiguous. What are we talking about here? The woman interpreted to mean what my family likes to do, what we all like to do. And one poor woman got caught up in this because the researcher didn't know he was going to get these differences. And he said, what do you like to do? We like to go boating. What do you like about boating? She said, nothing. I get sick. And then she realized, I'm sounding like an idiot. And then she said, but it's fun because the kids love playing out with the tubes out behind the boat, and it's fun. It's just a nice family outing. Now, look, there's two ways to look at this poor woman. You could say, she's crazy. She's living through her kids. This is terrible. I don't see it that way. I say, isn't it wonderful that there's more people in the world who can't be happy unless the people around them are happy? Is that bad? I don't think it's bad. I think that's quite admirable. And I think that women often take the lead in creating relationships, binding families, and building societies. Okay, I'm finished talking at you. I'd be interested in your thoughts. Questions, please. Yes. The women here. So, I've taught this class a lot, a class on this, and some of the women say they're successful, and they say, well, I just say, no, I can't do that, but hey, if you want to go catch a bite down the mall or something, give me a call. And so they make it very clear that, you know, that's not the way they interact with boys. And I think if, you know, you got to train boys to some extent. You have to, you know, they'll do whatever they have to do to spend Saturday night with women. You know, so you can set the framework, but obviously it's hard if other women are behaving very differently. And I think that's where you can maybe say to these other women, this is the part, women hate to be mean to anybody, much less other women, but look, you do gossip a lot, and maybe you could be a little more purposeful in your gossiping. You know, because the fact of the matter is that some women are really hurting other women's chances to have a what used to be considered a reasonable dating environment. And women can't live without women's friendships. So I think that they, to some extent, you can just do it that way. To a certain extent, you have to just tell yourself, well, you know, there's lots of guys who like to sleep with women who want to marry chaste women, and I'm going to win in the end. And that seems terrible and double standard, but it's the truth that the guys who are running around, haven't grown up yet, will not want to marry the people they've been sleeping with along the way. And partly because that's built into them. You know, you worry about whether it's your kid or not if you marry that sort of woman. But I think, I don't know, there's this outfit I'm associated with called the Network of Enlightened Women, another, like, off the hook, a good outfit on campus here. It's on a number of college campuses. And they're right now in the midst of a gentleman's showcase. They think, they like to, people who are gentlemen, they want anybody to nominate, so they have all kinds of women nominating guys. This is the outstanding gentleman. Here's why. He really helped me carry books up. I was really in trouble. I barely knew him. I was just moving into my new place. Or, you know, he's always opens doors. He's just a real wonderful manners. So then they have people vote online for who's the greatest gentleman, and there's a big award for him and so on. The kids, the guys are kind of, you know, well, I don't know. You know, but the point is, to make it clear that you appreciate guys who behave in this way. I think it was a neat idea to do something like that. But it's tough. I think it should be enormously encouraging that this trend is toward more abstinence. I mean, that nobody would have predicted that. Cats, you know, horse out of the barn, you're not going back in, they'll never change. It's starting to change. And the other thing that women have to tell themselves is, I don't get anything out of it. I don't like casual sex. I'm much more likely to get a sexual transmitted disease. It's much more likely to affect my fertility than it is men. I'm in a different place than he is. You know, I'm just not going there. I'm interested in somebody who wants to get to know me and ultimately finding a husband. And I think that if women knew, you know, these are the results of the hookups and maybe a cohabitation or two, and then I'm 29, how that's going to feel like, they'd be more purposeful in their dating now. I think a lot of women think, oh, it's too scary to get married. But I think it's scary to have to put up with this jungle out there if you're not married. You know? I got married when I was 28. My wife is 23. Before we even thought about having kids, we went to Europe, just had a wonderful time. I mean, women like emotional connection with a special partner, and they like sex within that. Why are you scared about getting married? You know, that's what you're looking for. And I think that you'd be more purposeful in the way you see the opposite sex if you took more seriously, look, I'd rather be married before I'm 25, and therefore there's certain guys who haven't grown up, and I'm not, you know, I'm just not interested in hanging out with them. Other questions, please? Yes, sir. Act what? Yeah. Right. Well, are you thinking about sex or nurturing or all of them in this regard? Perfectly ordinary male. I think that's fair. In other words, it seems to me that feminists would be particularly worried about the exceptions. How are they going to feel? But it depends very much on what the evidence is, you know, and how broadly I'm right. I think I'm most broadly right on things having to do with reproduction, and therefore nurturing babies and sex. These differences are enormous. Now, as far as a boy who wants to play with a doll, I think that happens a lot. I think fathers get worried about it. I'm not saying there isn't, they can. My father did. I remember my younger brother was playing with dolls and he got worried about it. I don't doubt that there's socialization, but I think it's normal and sweet, and I think most parents think it's sweet when a young boy gets interested in a new baby. I don't think there is great pressure against that. But I think, you know, there's definitely, you're talking about bell curves, and there are exceptions, and I guess without more concrete, if it's a question of a boy wants to play with a doll, I say fine. Although I guess I would ultimately say, look, what is one of the reasons boys, parents worry about boys and girls being very atypical? You know, a girl who never cares about how she looks, won't let him comb her hair, you know, wears dressy jeans, shirt tails always hanging out. You know, parents might say, I'm kind of hoping you get married and have grandchildren someday. You know, this, you know, I hope this is just a phase. She's probably thinking this. Maybe she's not putting a lot of pressure on it, but, you know, guys tend to care a lot about how girls look. And for boys, girls don't like sissies. So if there's a sense that somehow he's always withdrawing from combat and from conflict and people are pushing him around, then they may worry a little bit too. But I think that most parents will say, you know, this is my kid, and I'll try to encourage him to stand up for himself a little more than he does now. But he's never going to be a big brute type kid, and I love him. And as I mentioned, these low testosterone guys often get the nicest girls in the end because they get good jobs and they're reliable and they make good husbands. And the female attraction to the bad boys, fortunately, tends to die out as they get older. I'm not sure that fully answered, but maybe we can talk after the break if it didn't, because there were other hands I wanted to get to. Yes, sir. Right. Well, the best thing to do is to have a grandmother around. One of the biggest problems with daycare is it's so sporadic. You know, people quit. People have kids of their own that quit. And even the strongest feminists who study this say the most important thing is to have the same caretakers. Grandmother's not going away. She's always going to love the kid. So live near your grandmother if you really want a high-powered career, and hope that she loves kids more than you do, maybe. Right? That's one thing. But beyond that, I think, look, women are thriving. They can do all these careers so well. But I guess I would say you probably have some sense already how you're going to be when you have a kid. If you go ooh and ah every time you see a baby, it's going to get worse when you have a kid, when it's your kid. You know, if you want to hold it, if you love babysitting, that would be a sign to you about how you're going to feel when this conflict comes up. And I say, think about a job that you enjoy doing, that's relatively easy to get in and out of, so that you can quit it for 5 years. It's not an accident that nursing and teaching, which has the summers off, are so popular with women. And nursing, you can always get a job as a nurse after taking time off. But sometimes you can as a doctor or part-time lawyer too, you know. But I think you should think about whether or not what I'm passionate about will fit with when I have a kid. And there's lots of jobs that do fit reasonably well. And if your husband dies or something, that you'd have something you could do that would make a good income. But I do think it's overstated that we really need two incomes these days than you didn't in the 60s. Because we're richer than they were in the 60s. The average male makes more money after controlling for inflation than they did in the 60s. So it's partly because we're more materialistic and we like to keep up with other people. And we think we have to have two jobs. I'm not opposed to anybody having these two jobs if they want. I'm just want to emphasize that only, 28% of women want a full-time job if they have a kid under 15. I think if we paid attention to their preferences, then instead of talking about subsidized daycare or paid parental leave, we'd be talking about dependence allowances. An increase in dependence allowance doesn't tilt. If you're a stay-at-home mom, it helps. If you're a working mom, it helps. We need more support for kids for families with kids. And then don't kind of coerce people to have to work because I'm already paying for the subsidized daycare, I'm already paying for parental leave. And even if you're not paying with taxes, you're paying with higher costs because the world is less productive, let's face it. If if women stop working for 6 months because there's paid, required paid leave. It's not as if that isn't causes. Other questions, please. Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you about changing culture. Do you believe that it's possible to change the way we think about sex or gender? Do you think it's possible to do that without the religious revival in America? Or do you think you first must God to bring about that culture?
Well, I think religious revival is a big, big help. There's no doubt about it. I had this one guy in my class was a Marine. He would come to, it was the day to wear the uniform when I had the class. He was handsome, tall, athletic-looking guy. And he, when we talked about all this stuff, he said, well, you know, I take my religious vows seriously. Boy, do I want to get married. You know, that's, I think if people are more religious, marriages will come earlier. And I think that that's an enormous help. It's very hard. This is why, in a way, I'm trying to figure out what you can tell to guys who aren't religious. And I think it has to start with the fact that they have to know that women don't like this. Because the problem is if the woman's crying the next morning, because I thought he was really interested in me, I saw him this morning, he didn't even acknowledge me, he acted like he didn't even know me. You know, she's going back and crying, her roommates know, but she's also saying, oh, don't tell him, don't tell him. I'd be so embarrassed, you know? I get papers all the time from women, so my roommate, it's terrible. I've seen so many roommates go through this all. But the guys say, really? You know, the guys in the class don't necessarily know this. Really? In other words, women have to make it clear that, look, there may be an outlier, but we don't like this. After how many, when I ask if upperclassmen or underclassmen women like the hookup scene more, everybody says underclassmen. They're the easy pickings, and the frat guys call them fresh meat. That's a lot of fun, isn't it? The new girls are fresh because they don't know they don't know what's going on. The older women have tired of this, and they do know what's going on. But the point is, I think women have to make it clear to men that this, we don't like this. And then the men can think about, you know, I really shouldn't whisper I love you if I could care less about this person. That's really not a nice thing to do. And other men can say, that really wasn't a nice thing to do, you're right. But I absolutely agree with you. It would be much easier if it has a religious revival behind it. Because men who think sex is just like basketball, only better, have to have some reason why they don't want to do it anyway. And I do think, you know, after a while they begin to think it's tawdry and so on. They maybe see this, but they need a reason, and they're not getting that reason now because women, it's not clear that women don't like it, and that you really are misleading them. Many times. Yes. Well, it's harder, but one of the things I have in my book is a Cosmo poll asking guys, would you be interested in dating someone you slept with on the first time you were out with them? And what they said, 74% of the men say no. You know, so if women are saying, you know, this is a way I'll get him interested and so on, there's also evidence that guys, when they're really interested in a woman, also want to slow it down physically. So, you know, a guy who's pressing very hard for a lot of physical stuff early on, that's a signal he doesn't much care about you. You know, that really is the signal. If he gets really interested and feels this is someone I'm really, this could be a keeper, he doesn't usually behave that way. Anything else? Yes, sir. Yeah. You know, that's a very good question, and I consider it in my class. As far as the sexual realm, I'm not sure. Although I had all kinds of papers by students who were guessing about this. I think certainly a lot of parents, especially of teenage girls, like it for that purpose. This one guy who had a mother who'd done a remarkable amount of teaching in different environments, single-sex girls, single-sex boys, public, talked to her about it, and she said that she thinks it's very helpful in middle school. This guy thought it wasn't as helpful in high school because he thought girls were even more innocent when they got to college if they were in all-girls school, and they just didn't have a clue what these guys were like. I guess what I can speak more confidently about is I do think that there's a really interesting movement towards single-sex education for cognitive reasons, that boys develop less quickly, that they get put in the slow learner classes, and worse yet, these female teachers assign all these books about teenage girls and their feelings. And, you know, the evidence seems to be that girls will read anything that's assigned and boys will read whatever's interesting. So they get all these books that are not about adventures and not about wars and not about sports. They're about things they have no interest in. And then they're told to write an essay, you know, how would you feel if you were Elizabeth? You know, I'm never going to be Elizabeth. You know, I think there's a lot of schooling that doesn't understand boys especially. I mean, the guy by the name of Leonard Sachs has a really good book called Why Gender Matters, and he's active in promoting single-sex public education. And here's so many differences he mentions that I wasn't aware of, that boys don't hear as well, and they always want to sit in the back. And girls hear, this is partly biological, you know, they have to hear well, they have to hear that baby's slightest murmur. So girls don't like high volumes, but they hear low volumes better than boys. So the boys should be made to sit up front. And the girls sometimes complain that the guy's a shouter. You know, the teacher's a shouter because it's too loud for them. What are some of the others? Guys, of course, are much slower in reading, and it's a real problem because they get put in the slow learner thing, and they're not really slow learner for a boy. But girls are just much better, quicker verbally, much earlier. And he has a lot of other differences. Oh, yeah, one of his nice ones, he says, you know, world-famous flautist, John Paul, Ron Paul, and there's another one who's a male. And yet when you ever look at any high school orchestra, they always seem to be girls play the flute. Sachs said, I'll bet those guys went to an all-boys school. He looked it up, and yep, they went to all-boys prep school. So he thinks that single-sex education will actually break down a lot of stereotypes. Somebody's got to play the flute, man. Sorry. You know, girls, somebody's got to play the drums. All right. You know, and...